You are now listening to the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. As always, I am your host, Daniel Lee of Photos by DOEE. On today's episode, we're going to be discussing the downsides of using multiple camera brands, some photography news, announcements, releases, and all that, as well as personal updates, which I will get into now. So I've been really enjoying the Fuji. I was going to do this post purely about this episode was going to be about the Fuji, but I did actually catch a cold last week, so I had no voice, so I didn't think I'd be able to even talk in time to release, you know, this week. I'm usually record it a lot earlier. This time I'm recording it just 2 days before it releases, so it's late for me. Luckily we have a public holiday here, so my voice is recovered in time. Hopefully it holds up to be able to record. So the topic's a little bit different, still good. That Fuji one will come, but I think honestly by the time I'm, you know, ready to release that Fuji, it'll be more of a review because I'm taking a lot of photos every single week with that camera. It does have its challenges in some areas, has great parts. Loving image quality, autofocus is still the only thing that I'm a bit not sold on. Otherwise, everything else is really good mostly. Been wanting to shoot more, but it's been really cold. Like each night, it's like 2 degrees and that kind of stuff, like really, really cold. Well, it feels like 2 degrees anyway. In our weather app here, like the Bureau of Meteorology, their app, the bomb app, it will have like what the actual temperature is. So say it's like 10 degrees, but it feels like 2 degrees. So I always go off what the feels like is, because if it feels like that, that's what it is to me. But it's been really cold. So I did manage to go out shooting a little bit yesterday, which, you know, main topic will be sort of related to is what inspired this topic, but we'll get more into that after. Otherwise, I don't know if I'll actually go to get out to shoot Vivid Lights before Vivid ends. It's been on for 2 weeks, but yeah, I'm just lazy. I never want to get sick these days because that means I can't exercise and I'm already hurt my foot. So that's, you know, just annoying. My main focus in every single day now is just exercising and somewhat dieting. So doesn't really work out as well. So yeah, otherwise that's pretty much it for personal updates. Not much has been happening for me aside from the Fuji. So let's get onto the news. This one is probably the oldest out of all of them because it did happen quite a few weeks ago, but Fujifilm has launched the X-H2S. Now, Fujifilm has announced the company's new flagship X-series mirrorless camera, the X-H2S, which features a new 26.16 megapixel APS-C stacked backside illuminated sensor, which is with a greatly improved autofocus system and up to 6.2K video recording in 10-bit 4:2:2. Fujifilm's 26 megapixel X-Trans CMOS 5 HS imaging sensor, which is both stacked and backside illuminated, that allows it to read data 4 times faster than Fujifilm's previous X-Trans CMOS 4 sensor, which is, you know, your X-T4, I believe also my X-S10, that kind of stuff. The new processor 5, which Fujifilm says has twice the processing power of its predecessor, which is obviously very impressive, kind of like how Canon went from the Digic 9 to Digic X, the Digic 10, and that one greatly improved their processing power, which makes a huge difference, more than people realize. Camera that can apply AEAF tracking for blackout-free continuous shooting up to 40 frames per second, which is very impressive. Fujifilm says it can write over 1,000 frames continuously when shooting JPEGs at 30 frames per second and can shoot up to 20 frames per second in RAW. All of these specifications are with the electronic shutter, not mechanical. AF has the best subject tracking in the X series history. Developed with deep learning technology, the company has also expanded subject detection and tracking from the human face and eyes to now include animals, birds, cars, motorcycles, bicycles, airplanes, and trains. Fujifilm says the X-H2S controls phase detection pixels independently from the image displays when in burst mode, which triples the number of calculations in phase detection from the X-T4 and enables high-speed focusing even during high-speed continuous shooting, which to me sounds very similar to how Canon's dual pixel AF works, which is, you know, each pixel is multiple. It works as both autofocusing thing and for, you know, light gathering. But maybe it's very similar. They found another way around it, but who knows? It also has a top-facing LCD and a heavy-duty body. Shutter can withstand 500,000 actuations. Has dual memory card slots, one for SD, and which wasn't specified at the time of announcement whether it's going to be UHS 1 or UHS 2, and one CF Express Type B slot. The EVF is a 5.76 million dot panel, very good, with a 0.8 magnification and a refresh rate of approximately 120 frames per second. Wow, who would have thought it'd be hard to say that, but maybe that's why I usually say FPS, 120 FPS. There we go, see, much easier. And this will be available in early July for $2,499, which is very different to what we're paying here. So I don't know why Fuji Australia just want to milk us as much as they can, but from what I remember seeing, it's around 4,400 AUD, which is a significantly large amount. Here, they like to put everything really expensive and put it on sale for like $1,000 off down to the actual price. The Canon R6 is $2,499 USD from what I remember, but you can get it on sale all the time for like 3,400 AUD. So I would say, you know, eventually this body will come down to about 3,400 AUD, which is expensive still, in my opinion, for an APS-C, but it is their flagship body. I have a sort of thing where when it gets to a certain price, I don't see the benefit of buying an APS-C camera. You know, like, I know people who are into bird photography. If you could get like the same AF as, you know, a full frame as the R6, R5, which, you know, very, very excellent AF, which I'm pretty much talking about the R7 here, but if you can get that AF, you know, but then have that extra reach, as they want to call it, then it will be better. But it's really, really dependent on the person. Otherwise, this camera mix, I'd say it does look good to me, way out of my price point. The body looks really nice. A lot of people are not happy, or Fuji users anyway, are not happy because it has a PASM dial, P-A-S-M. So with most Fuji cameras, if you're not aware, they have manual dials. Not most, but certain lines have manual dials. So if you want to change your aperture, you have a dial, or the aperture, sorry, ring on the lens. You know, you have a shutter dial, ISO dial, everything's dials. Whereas with these ones, they're PASM. So it's pretty much, you know, put into auto if you want a manual, and you're just adjusting it with blank dials that you can sort of customize to an extent. For me, I prefer PASM. I don't like manual dials. I don't like aperture rings. But, you know, obviously this is for, I'd say this one, because they're rumored to be announcing XH2, which is a 40 megapixel sensor. So I would assume that one will be the old manual style, and this XH2S will be the one with the PASM dial, the PASM. And that one's more open to bigger market. I know people think it's against Fuji's principles to do this kind of stuff, but it's good for them to differentiate. I can tell you for a fact, if the XH10 was the exact same camera, but it didn't have PASM, I would not buy it. Simple as that, because I don't like manual dials. For me, that's a massive deal breaker. So, you know, having these cameras like this XH2S, the XS10 with the PASM dials opens them up to a new market of people like myself. So I personally think it's good that they're doing that and doing something a bit different, having a bit of a differentiation. They just need to have your high end, mid end, and low end of each. So say your high end will be the XH2. You know, when talking manual dials, high end XH2, mid end XT4, low end, I don't know the Fuji bodies that well, XE4 or something. And then your high-end XH2S for PASM, mid-end XS10, and the low-end, I don't know what that would be either. I don't even know what other ones have PASM so far, but they just need to simplify because they have a lot of bodies. You know, Joey, my friend, messaged me about how their lineup works because there's so many cameras, which I see a common criticism online of Fuji for that too. They do have way too many bodies. They need to simplify it. It's good to have, you know, I feel like that's when Sony were doing their best, was when they had just a very simple lineup. They have kind of too many bodies now. You had your high megapixels, your more video orientated, and your entry level camera. And then when they added the A9 series, that made sense, you know, your speed orientated camera. You just have, each camera needs to have its very clear purpose rather than have like five cameras that do the exact same thing. But yeah, that's it for that one. So next one, Fuji unveils the XF 18-120 f4 and 150-600 f5 to 5.6 to f8 lens. So the Fujifilm 18-120 is designed for photographers and filmmakers alike. Fujifilm says it makes the first collaboration between Fuji Non-Optics and Fuji X series engineers to create a hybrid solution for motion production and enthusiasts. It's a 6.7 times powered zoom, hence PZ in the name, that Fujifilm says still manages to be compact. The lens is constructed of 15 elements in 12 groups, including 3 aspherical elements and 3 extra low dispersion elements that Fujifilm says effectively suppresses spherical aberration, distortion, and chronic aberration. Fujifilm says that the aspherical and ED elements were designed for both size and weight efficiency and weigh just over 1 pound and measure about 4.9 inches long. The front filter thread is 72 millimeters. Now, with the Fuji XF18-120, PZWR is expected to be available in or around September 22 for $899. For the XF50-150-600mm, is engineered for wildlife photographers, obviously with that range, combined with newly announced XHS2 camera and its improved autofocus system. The company says that the 150-600 f5.6 to f8 lens can provide incredible zoom even in the most challenging situations. Now, the lens is constructed of 24 elements in 17 groups, including 3 ED elements and 4 super ED elements that Fujifilm says deliver an advanced level of image resolution edge to edge across the entire zoom range. The lens covers the 35mm equivalent focal length of 229-229mm through 914mm, which can be extended further with the 1.4 and 2x Fuji teleconverters, giving the lens a maximum throw of 120mm, which is 35mm equivalent of 1,828mm, which would be great for moonshots. Despite this huge range, the lens only weighs about 3.5 pounds. Now, the autofocus system is driven by a linear motor, and Fujifilm says it can attain precise focus quickly and accurately, and the lens is expected to be available in early July for $1,999. Now, it's kind of funny, for the latter, the XF150-600mm, apparently DP Review messed up a little bit in regards to this one from what I've been reading online, especially from Fuji rumors. So apparently they gave not some great review of that lens based on their impressions, but apparently they had used the X-T4, not the new XH2S. And supposedly, according to Fuji rumors, Fuji gave the clear instructions to only use the 150-600 with the X2HS, but they use the X-T4, and a firmware update is needed for the X-T4 to work properly with that lens. So their results were not good because of that. So apparently they end up taking the gallery down because of that, because, you know, it's not representative of what the actual performance of that lens is. So yeah, a little bit of online drama there, always fun to read, but otherwise, you know, I'm sure a lot of bird photographers and that who do shoot Fuji will be very excited about both the lens and the body combination. Next up, Sony unveils 3 APS-C lenses for hybrid photo video shooters. So Sony has announced 3 new lenses that have been designed with hybrid photographer videographer in mind: the 10-20mm f4 PZ, the 50mm f1.4, and the 11mm f1.8. Sony has created these 3 new lenses designed for video focus shooters with Sony's APS-C cameras, but have the capability to provide excellent performance for stills captures as well. First up, the 10-24 f4 is a power zoom, which seems to be becoming very, very popular recently. Edge-to-edge sharpness thanks to 2 ED elements and 1 ED aspherical element. It has dual linear motors for the autofocus, minimum focus distance of 10-20cm, depending on the wide or the long end, 175 grams or 6.2 ounces, and will be available in July for $750. Sony describes the 50mm f1.4G as a professional level wide angle prime lens with Sony G-Glass image quality. Now, suppose distortion-free images, even at 50mm, and linear focus motor. The lens uses 3 aspherical elements to allow for excellent resolving power and corner-to-corner sharpness. Has a 7-bladed aperture, which is quite strange because usually Sony like to go 9 or 11, like usually 11 for a lot of their lenses. Generally, how it affects it is the more aperture blades, generally the more round the bokeh balls will be. So that's why it's good to have, that's why I find lenses like the 85GM are so round, because of the fact they use 11 blades. Otherwise, it has multiple body controls, including a declickable aperture, manual focus, autofocus switch, and a focus hold button, which you can usually customize, which, you know, I know most people set as IAF. Minimum focus distance of about 20 centimeters or 7.89 inches, and available in July for $740. The last one, the 11mm f1.8, has 3 spherical elements, a linear focus motor, and 7 aperture blades. Has a minimum focusing distance of 12 centimeters and available in July for $550. So all of these pretty decently priced, really expanding their APS-C lineup, which, you know, usually arguably needs the most attention because Sony, Canon, Nikon, they don't tend to give as much love to APS-C. But otherwise, you know, I'm sure these lenses will make a lot of people happy. That 50mm f1.4, although, you know, they're touting it as a video lens, it is the equivalent to what, like 23, 24 millimeters, somewhere around there anyway. 16 is 24, so I'd say this is around 23 millimeters, so it's still pretty wide. My maths is very bad as well. But I'm sure photographers would love that 50mm f1.4 for astro and that kind of stuff. So it will have its uses, that's for sure, for both, depending on what you kind of shoot, video or photos. Next up, Sigma announces a 16mm f2.8 DGDN lens for Sony, E, and Leica L. So Sigma has announced the 60mm 2.8 DGDN, a wide-angle zoom lens designed for Sony E-mount and Leica L-mount, and can be used on all full-frame cameras of those brands. The 60mm 16-28 lens has 5 FOD elements and 4 spherical lens elements to ensure optimal image quality with minimal aberrations. The lens has inner zoom mechanics that keep the overall length consistent throughout the entire zoom range, helping it feel balanced in the hand. The inner zoom also means the lens center of gravity stays fairly constant, so Sigma says it's perfect for gimbal use. A front filter thread allows filters to be attached more easily as well. The lens weighs in at 450 grams and measures just over 100 millimeters in length, and Sigma says that it is a highly practical optic that is portable enough for everyday shooting. It has a stepping AF motor. The lens is made lightweight, firmly stable of made. The lens is made of lightweight, firmly stable composite, so it does feel solid, but at the same time, it's lighter. It comes with a pedal-type lens hood, and it has an aperture range of f2.8 to f22, a minimum focusing distance of 25 centimeters or 9.9 inches, or it's also releasing late June for $899 for Sony and Leica. Sample images do look quite nice. I know there's a lot of video reviews out for it already. I think a lot of reviewers had it in advance, weeks and however many before. Dustin Abbott's one was quite interesting. I believe he compared it with the Tamron 17-28, which found the 17-20, I think something like that, which found the Sigma was sharper in the edges, whereas the Tamron was sharper in the center, the inner two-thirds, I believe. So depending on, you know, what you prioritize, I would probably prefer the Tamron, but it really comes down to what you like and what you, you know, prioritize. To me, center sharpness should always be the priority over corner sharpness. You know, obviously it's not that extreme, but there's no point in having, you know, tack sharp bush in the corner, but then your subject in the center is kind of blurry and that kind of stuff, which, yeah, doesn't make sense. Otherwise, that is it for the news. So on to the main topic. Now, as I've mentioned a few times, I recently got a new body, which is the Fuji. Now, I usually do like to own more than one sort of body brand, so that way, you know, got the best of both worlds kind of thing. Often as there are upsides to owning multiple brands, there's also downsides. Maybe next week will be upsides of owning multiple camera brands, but this week we're doing downsides. So yesterday at the time of recording, I went out shooting and I had to learn something the hard way. So one great feature of modern mirrorless bodies is IBIS, so in-body image stabilization. Pretty much the sensor can move around to stabilize any movement that you may have. You may think this is only a good thing, and honestly, it's really good. It's game-changing. It's something I must have in my bodies, hence why I went for the Fuji and didn't really want to keep the M50. But there's also downsides to this, one, namely shooting on a tripod. So I found, you know, most manufacturers do recommend to turn off IBIS or any IS when you're shooting on a tripod, you know, because how it works is if there's no movement, it'll still compensate for that, which will end up making the shot blurry. Because, you know, when you're hand holding, there is slight movement, so that's what the IBIS does, it compensates for that. But then if there's no movement, you end up with a blurry image. Now, from what I've noticed anyway, I haven't done any full tests side by side, but I've never had to worry about that with Canon. I know some people say that Canon cameras can detect when you're on a tripod. How they can detect this, I don't know, but I'm assuming that they can detect that there's absolutely zero movement and they disable it. But I know for a fact when I've shot cityscapes, never had to worry about the IBIS interfering. I can't remember if it's the same with Sony or not. It's been so long. I think I may have disabled it back when I shot with Sony as well. But either way, you know, usually it's generally recommend you disable it. When I went out to shoot with Fuji, now on my Canon cameras, I don't really use it, but on this Fuji, I use all the custom modes, C1, C2, C3, C4, and I have different film presets, like film, you know, looks added to each one, simulations, but the settings also do change. So say I'm in, which happened, I was in C3 or C2 or whatever, and then I had IBIS set to being off. When I swap to C4, it changes all my settings, so IBIS comes back on. Even if I swap back, I believe it will still stay, it will still come back on. So I took my cityscapes, you know, just had a quick look in the camera. They looked to be pretty decent, but then when I got home and I looked at them, the sharpness is nowhere near what I usually get with the Fuji. The Fuji is usually way, way sharper with that 23mm lens. Albeit, I did stop down a lot to like f16, but even the f9 shots are quite bad, which puzzled me for a second. But then I remembered IBIS. I turned it off, but then I turned the camera off, changed settings around. It would have re-enabled it. And when I checked the camera to see if it was still enabled, yes, IBIS was still enabled, which to me seems most likely the issue. With Canon, it was never an issue for me. So hence where the whole, you know, downside of shooting two different bodies that work, two different brands, sorry, that work very differently can be an issue. Then, you know, thankfully what helped me grow this topic. So here's sort of three areas that I would say the downsides of shooting different brands. So number one, ergonomics. So ergonomics can be different. Obviously, you know, each camera manufacturer designs their bodies different for a different feel, different hold, different everything. So, you know, dials will always be in a different spot. Buttons will be in a different spot. Sure, you know, you can customize a lot of these buttons and dials often, you know, most of the time, but that doesn't change the fact that they could still be in a different position. I know, you know, with Canon, the play button to review an image is in the bottom right, which I personally prefer. Whereas on the Fuji, it's in the top left. So when you're holding the camera, you know, generally the right hand will be gripping the grip and the left hand, you usually hold the lens to stabilize it. So when you want to review an image straight after taking it, with the Canon, you can just move your thumb to the bottom of the camera, press it, and you don't even need to move it. Whereas with the Fuji being the top right, you sort of have to move your hand. It sounds like very minor things, but you know, just those small little things can really affect you because you know, you'll find your muscle memory is so used to using a camera. I think most put their, thankfully, the AF on buttons, you know, for autofocus on the back, which is really good, especially if you use back button focus. But otherwise, you know, it's very, very different depending on which camera you use. You know, settings can be very different. Like I mentioned with IBIS, you know, on Canon, it seems to not affect tripod work, whereas on Fuji, it does. Certain accessories won't work as well. You know, like for example, Fuji, they don't actually make a native wireless trigger. Despite the camera having Bluetooth, there's no wireless trigger. You can use the phone app, which I hate using phone apps. It's always a hassle. I prefer with Canon, I have the BIE1, I think it is. It's a Bluetooth remote. That thing works beautifully. With Fuji, there is no such thing. You can get a third-party one from JJC that you have to sort of plug into the wired trigger, and then that uses radio frequency to trigger it, which is, you know, just more parts, more hassle kind of thing. But otherwise, you know, the muscle memory, I'd say, would be the worst part about using different bodies. Obviously, each person, you know, they may get used to it, and depending on how much you use of each body, it may not be an issue for you, but it is definitely different. You know, and also, like I said, for some people who prefer aperture rings, if you're going from that to another brand that doesn't frequently have them, although most manufacturers are sort of going that route, either aperture rings or control rings like Canon started using, they can sort of help. But if you're used to just, you know, adjusting on your lens and you don't have that, that can be a hassle and that can slow you down when you're shooting as well. The second area that it can sort of affect you, not for everyone, but you can't share lenses sometimes. So depending on what lenses you have. So if you have Canon RF lenses, can't use them on any other brand, period, you know. I believe with the way they're designed, they sit very, very close. The rear element's almost touching the sensor. It's that close. So that's why, you know, very, very different design. That's why they don't really work on other cameras from what I have read online anyway. You know, I've seen people use, I believe it is Sony lenses on Nikon through adapters. I know you can use Canon EF lenses on Fuji. So it is possible, but at the same time, you know, with adapters, they never work as well as native when they're third-party ones. So I'm not talking about your Nikon FX to Z adapter or Canon RF to EF adapter. Those work like native because they're made by the manufacturer. They know exactly what they're doing. But talking about your Metabones, your Sigma MC11, all those Photodiox ones, no offense to any of them, but they do work depending on the lens, but they'll never work like native. When I shot Sony, for example, and I used Canon EF lenses, the EF 35mm F2IS worked practically near native on the Sony. It was really great, but obviously extends the length, extends the size, extends the weight of the whole package, you know? But at the same time, when I use another lens like the 16-35, the AF definitely wasn't that great. The 100L as well didn't quite work as, you know, great compared to a native option like the Sony 90mm. For me, I think it's always better to have the native lenses or have that native performance. Some people don't mind adapting and manual focus or whatever, but it is something you do have to keep in mind. If you don't like the idea of having to have two gear kits, then that's definitely a downside, especially if you want, you know, the best performance, like native performance on both. So really, really have to take all that into mind. And then sometimes, you know, the camera manufacturer may update the firmware, which can break that third-party support. Like, no one knows why Samyang stopped making RF lenses for Canon, or supposedly they've stopped supplying them. Whether it was the firmware updates were killing the lenses or what, but who knows? So, we'll, you know, it's really up to you if you do see this as a downside. I personally do, but each person is different, you know? Last but not least, editing can be different and increase the, you know, time or hassle of your workflow. So, not starting a war on color science or anything, but there is a definite difference between brands. Now, if you look at Canon, their files straight out of the camera do look different to Sony's, and Sony's look different to Fuji's. They're all different. With Fuji as well, you have your film simulations, which actually work as camera profiles. So if I shoot in Velvia, when I load the image into Lightroom or Adobe Camera Raw, it'll detect that camera profile, that Velvia camera profile. So my RAW file looks pretty much just like the JPEG, almost just like the JPEG. So it does save a lot of editing time. So, you know, if you're used to that, then you hop over to Canon. There's not really such a thing for Canon. To me, it seems like it will be pretty easy. You do have your camera profiles, like you can buy custom ones that make it look more like that, but you know, it's not native like the Fuji one is. So that's something you really have to keep in mind. If you have presets that you like, you know, you'd have to make double one for say you shoot Sony and shoot Canon. You'd have to have one for the Sony camera, one for the Canon, because you know, the way they react to color work is very different. Personally, it's going to sound crazy, I think I prefer the Fuji compared to the Canon. Canon's always love for their color science, but I'm, you know, actually I liked Sony's color science and the way their files worked. Because in all honesty, you can get the same look, same colors from both systems. It's more just, you know, there is more editing involved to get them to look the same. That is definitely true. But I actually enjoyed the way Sony files worked. They were a bit more sort of, I don't know if desaturated, they were a bit more flat in a way. So I like to shape the colors myself. So that really did help me in a way. And I find Fuji files do work very similar to Sony. I'm not sure if it's because it's backside illuminated, but at the same time, I don't believe my Sony a7 III had a backside illuminated sensor. I can't remember now, but that may be why it works different to the R6. The R6 is no way bad, or these Canon sensors are no way bad. The dynamic range on them is great. And then it's sort of unrelated, but I honestly do believe all manufacturers are baking in some noise reduction there. I know they say Canon are the only ones to do it, but from what, you know, the way the files look, I honestly don't think it's that. If you look at Sony, they have their star eater problem. If it's a raw image that has not been touched, why would it be eating stars? Unless they are doing some, you know, noise reduction, baked in noise reduction to the raw files to get that dynamic range. It's not like it's a bad thing. Who cares if, you know, the files are good, then who cares personally? But, you know, I believe all manufacturers are doing that, and that is literally what is happening. But in terms for editing, you know, if you're someone who likes to have the exact same flow, work with the exact same colors, all that kind of stuff, having different brands can definitely affect this and make it harder for you to have that very strict workflow. If you're used to, you know, adding more reds to your shadows and your highlights, you know, for example, you're used to doing that with Fuji, then if you swap over to Canon, that may not work. It may be too red then, you know. All of it is very minor stuff, but really, if you get used to a certain workflow, a certain process, anything could be a bit annoying when it comes to changing all of that. Otherwise, that's pretty much it. So those are the main three things I can see as downsides of shooting multiple camera brands. I believe next fortnight, guess what? We're going to cover what the main benefits are. Just a full disclosure here, I'm not sure if it will release on time. I may have to record it on a different schedule again, mainly because I got something big happening possibly in the next fortnight. So that's why, you know, I don't know what my schedule will be like, but otherwise there'll definitely be an episode. Just, I don't know if it'll be a few days late, maybe earlier, who knows. I'll update on Twitter. Anytime if I can't release an episode, I will post that on Twitter. So just follow me there if you want to receive updates. Otherwise, I don't spam. I don't post like 1,000 things a day. I pretty much only use it for post notifications. So otherwise, thank you very much for listening. All the links for the news articles and that are in the show notes. You can also find more episodes if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or through your RSS feed, which I see majority of people do. You can also visit thephotographyenthusiast.com to find more episodes with the full show notes and past episodes, as long as reviews, to very few tutorials, and a bit more. Otherwise, if you want to see my personal work, which is starting to pick up again, thankfully, you can visit photosbydlee.com. Otherwise, you can find me on Twitter at photosbydlee. Generally, you know, I post there, Flickr, and my blog. My blog the most, then Flickr, then Twitter. So yeah. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening. Stay safe, take care, and we'll see you in a fortnight. Bye.